Talofa Lava, this is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Elisha Foon. Coming up.
80% of children in countries, Solomon Islands, Tonga and Vanuatu, experience violence discipline in their homes by their caregivers.
New research shows an alarming rise in violence against children in the Pacific. Also, medicinal cannabis could be legally imported into the Cook Islands this month from Australia and New Zealand. And
the engagement visa allows the successful applicants for that visa to become permanent residents of Australia.
Pacific people who want to move to Australia now have the chance to do so on a new visa scheme. New research shows an alarming rise in violence against children in the Pacific. Save the Children's Pacific Regional Child Protection Situational Analysis revealed child protection risks have increased in the Pacific region over the past 5 years. Almost 200 children alongside 300 caregivers and 110 child protection staff across 5 countries took part. According to the findings, the rise in violence is down to COVID-19, increased migration, climate change and digital connectivity. I spoke with Save the Children New Zealand Advocacy and Research Director, Jackie Salvey, about the findings.
The findings of this research are deeply concerning to Save the Children, as it shows that there's a high prevalence of violence against children across the 5 countries that we conducted the research in the Pacific. So over 80% of child protection stakeholders in Vanuatu, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Tonga and Fiji perceived that violence against children had increased significantly in their countries. And children's experiences and what they reported confirmed those findings, that around 80% of children in countries, Solomon Islands, Tonga and Vanuatu, experience violent discipline in their homes by their caregivers. Other findings that we found is that caregivers in Fiji, Solomon Islands, Tonga and Vanuatu were most concerned about online violence against children. And we also found through this research that there's limited data when it comes to online violence and children's experience in the online world related to abuse and concerns. We did learn, however, that children themselves were even more concerned about the online violence, and they reported being exposed to harmful content, bullying, emotional harm, and that had a serious impact and in some cases had even led to suicide.
So the report shows progress has been made in legislative and policy reform to improve child protection, but implementation is challenging. So how do you address this?
Yes, the report has found that there's been significant progress over the past 10 to 15 years in strengthening child protection frameworks across the 5 countries. So in some cases, laws have been passed or legislation has been passed to protect children from violence and law. However, the frameworks or the systems, the child protection systems that implement these laws remain under-resourced and therefore weak. For us to fix that or for us to make change in the child protection system, it's going to require additional funding and resourcing. So it's also about training for the child protection specialist. But like we have seen here in New Zealand, there's a need for training across the workforce that deals on a day-to-day basis with children. And this includes teachers and health professionals, people in the communities that see children on a daily basis. Particularly needed is training for the child protection staff and that implementation, so that when a report of concern is made or a child experiences violence, there's a robust system to act on those reports to support the child as the victim and in their recovery from the violence, but also to hold the perpetrators to account. So this is going to take time and it's going to take investment and it's going to take training.
Where would you say is the greatest need or the highest levels of domestic violence in the Pacific? I know that this is widespread, but is there one particular country of concern?
Well, the research shows that the highest rates of violence against children through violent discipline from their caregivers was reported in Solomon Islands, Tonga and Vanuatu, 80% of children reporting those experiences. So these are the countries that show the highest rates of violence at that level, and we know that gendered violence or family violence is a driver of that, and also the use of drugs and alcohol by caregivers is another violent driver of that form of violence. and it fails to be, so there's lack of protective factors around that. When families have a higher level of income and higher levels of education in the family, that's a serious protective factor. So essentially, if we're to tackle those high rates in those countries, we need to bring up the education achievement rates across the country and also the socioeconomic standards of living to make sure that families have what they need. And alongside that is programs to tackle drug and alcohol abuse that are again those increasing factors of violence against children. Some of those socio-cultural and religious norms regarding gender and violence that have been dominant for decades need to be challenged, and we're seeing that happening at community levels. So, and this is proving to be effective. So for example, in Solomon Islands, there's a really strong social campaign about raising the age of marriage to 18 years. It's currently only 15. And so this is changing the socio-cultural perceptions of girls and marriage. And it's also, shows some gaps where children need to be 21 to go to a nightclub but can be married at 15. So it's challenging some of those norms about being girls being marriage property of their husbands, and which are quite entrenched. So we need the socio-cultural change at the community level led by community leaders, and then that needs to be supported by robust child protection or even gender protection systems where those that are victims of violence can go for help to report the violence, to recover from the violence and for perpetrators to be held to account. So for example, there's a no-drop policy, which means that children, when crimes are committed against children and reported to police, police are required to act on them through legal mechanisms rather than make deals or redress with the perpetrators and communities. And programs like that are important for shifting the harmful cultural norms that exist in many of these countries in the Pacific.
Medicinal cannabis could be legally imported into the Cook Islands this month from Australia and New Zealand. The Ministry of Health's Narcotics and Misuse of Drugs Amendment Act 2023 is set to be implemented on May 13th, pending Cabinet approval next week. Pharmacies will be able to apply to the Ministry of Health for a 12-month licence to import the drug after the law passes. It follows a legally non-binding referendum, where a majority of people voted in favour for medicinal cannabis. Caleb Fotheringham spoke to cannabis advocate Steve Boggs, who has been living in the Cook Islands.
I feel really good that they're going to allow local doctors to prescribe cannabis products. That's a major breakthrough. That's exciting. But like I said, we'll have to wait and see if they keep their word, when this is all going to happen, and what kind of cannabis products they're going to bring in. That's another thing they haven't really said. We don't know if it's just CBD or if it's bud and the whole... Well, they did say they were going to allow everything that's being prescribed in New Zealand and Australia to be able to be prescribed here, so hopefully they'll keep their word on that.
I know in New Zealand that people complain about medicinal cannabis being quite expensive. I don't actually know what the situation is in Australia, but are you concerned about how expensive some of these products could be?
The black market products here are just... cost prohibited. I mean, 0.4 grams of weed, it costs you $50, I've been told. So that's just outrageous. So I'm sure that the prices are going to be a lot better than that.
Is there anywhere that you want to see this go? Obviously, medicinal cannabis being able to be prescribed is a benefit to you. Do you want anything else? Do you want this to progress further, I suppose, to recreational cannabis eventually?
Yeah, well, this just to me is like putting your foot in the water, just crawling. The next thing I want to see is people are allowed to cultivate up to like 10 plants on their own and just register with the police or the Ministry of Health to do that so you can grow your own. And then I want to see it decriminalized so it's just a fine, or maybe no fine and absolutely no jail time whatsoever. And then the natural progression from there would be recreational legalization. That's what I want to see, and that's what I'm going to be aiming for.
This process really started in August 2022 when there was the non-binding referendum. Well, I suppose for you, actually, it started a little bit before that because you were campaigning for it. But from August 2022 to now, how do you feel the process has gone?
Well, I think it was too slow, but, I mean, that's what you got to expect down here. It takes a long time for anything to get done, but I think they moved too slow because it was an urgent matter. Too many people are going to jail, and the fines are really heavy. They're throwing people in jail for simple possession, and it just has to stop. They were too slow, but I have to accept what's going on and just chalk it up and say it's progress.
A veteran Solomon Islands journalist says she's not surprised at the lineup of the newly sworn-in ministers in her country so far. The new Solomon Islands Prime Minister, Jeremiah Manele, unveiled the first 11 members of the Solomon Islands Parliament at the weekend. Lydia Lewis has more on this developing story.
Veteran journalist Dorothy Wickham says several independent MPs were pulled in to form this government, and this lineup reflects that.
I think there was some disappointment expressed by some people about a particular minister who got his past portfolio, which is the Minister for Mines and Energy. I think people were expecting someone new in that, but they've given it to the same member of parliament again. So you could see it in social media, a lot of people talking about it and being disappointed.
Some negatives, but some positives too. The new Minister for the Ministry of Public Service, John Tuheika, brings a wealth of experience from working at the World Bank, and he's touted as one to keep an eye on.
He has a good track record in terms of work integrity. So we're hoping to see good things come out of him. If he has a good permanent secretary working with him, I think he'll achieve a lot. And he's also young, and he's first time in Parliament and in politics too, so he'll be a person to watch, I think.
Key positions in Solomon Islands Parliament are yet to be announced, including the Deputy Prime Minister. As of Monday, New Zealand time, 12 ministers had yet to be sworn in, leaving finance and treasury and infrastructure and development portfolios still on the table. She says there's a lot of chatter on social media about the remaining portfolios.
Scrolling through and reading up on all the comments and forums, I think that the next group will be made up more of the our party grouping, because this seems to be the more senior portfolios, like Minister of Finance and Foreign Affairs and all these portfolios. I think they're going to be looking at their more experienced and their core group to be holding on to these portfolios.
Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele's administration, which calls itself the Government for National Unity and Transformation, is made up of three parties. His own Aul Party is the largest, followed by Manase Mailanga's People's First Party and Jamie Vokia's Kandere Party.
For the latest on this story and more, head to our website, rnzi.com. Pacific people who want to move to Australia now have the chance to do so on a new visa scheme. There are 3,000 places available, with most Pacific countries given a quota that people can enter a ballot for, which opens on June 3rd. The head of the Australian National University's Development Policy Centre, Stephen Howes, told Don Wiseman what the Australian Engagement Visa is offering.
The Engagement Visa allows the successful applicants for that visa to become permanent residents of Australia. So it's quite similar to New Zealand's Samoa quota and Pacific Access category for other countries. It operates through a ballot because it's anticipated it will be oversubscribed. And then those who are successful in the ballot, if they pass the health check and the police check, and if they're able to land a job in Australia, they're then able to move with their family to Australia and become permanent residents. So the visa has been, it was announced actually, I think a couple of years ago now, and it was always going to be 3,000 visas per year, at least initially. And last year, the government passed the necessary legislation to make this visa operational. But what it's done just now is actually announce how these 3,000 visas are going to be divided up between the various participating Pacific countries.
So the Development Policy Centre, what do you think of the way they've broken up that quota? Well, I titled my blog Winners and Losers. I think that's one way to look at it. Almost half of the visas go to PNG, so you'd have to say PNG's a winner. Although, if it was strictly done on a basis of population, of course, many more would go to PNG because it is such a big country relative to the rest of the Pacific. But still, with almost half the visas, you'd have to say that PNG was a winner. I think Fiji emerges as a winner, and that's a bit of a surprise because the point of this visa is to build up the diaspora. The Pacific diaspora in Australia, and Fiji is one of the few countries that already has a pretty healthy diaspora. So does Tonga, which gets 150. So it's not exactly clear how these quotas were allocated. The government said it depended on population, it depended on the diaspora, but it also depended on their discussion with the actual partner government. So perhaps some governments were keener than others. At the other end, the big surprise actually is that out of the 3,000, they've only allocated 2,700, so there are 300 left unallocated. On the other hand, there are three countries that haven't been given any allocation yet: Samoa, Kiribati, and Marshall Islands. So, sort of reading between the lines, you'd think that the discussions haven't concluded with those three countries, but that these 300 visas have been earmarked for them. So, you know, at least for now, you'd have to say that Samoans, Kiribati, and the citizens of the Marshall Islands are missing out. But it looks like that might only be a short-term problem.
Interestingly, they have got an allocation for for two of the compact countries. Why would they have done that, given the strong links of those places to the US?
Yeah, that's right. And I think you can be critical of that because all the citizens of FSM Palau and RMI can move to America indefinitely. It is true they can't actually become permanent residents in the United States. You know, whereas here, as soon as they get the visa, they become permanent residents of Australia. So it may still be attractive for those countries. But I guess the reason that Australia did it is that this is sort of meant to be a Pan-Pacific initiative. It's meant to make Australia more part of the Pacific family. As I said, it's meant to build up the diaspora, including the diaspora from these three nationalities. And so it's more of an inclusive approach that's being taken, you know, rather than really focusing on only those countries that really lack migration opportunities at the moment.
And why no allocation for Kiribati, do you think?
Well, we've heard that the Kiribati government has said they need more time. I understand relations between Kiribati and Australia. You know, there's a lot of perhaps tension or unresolved issues around China. But it's really not clear, you know, beyond that they need more time. It's really not clear sort of why neither Kiribati nor Samoa have claimed a quota. It may be in the case of Samoa, they're worried about brain drain and people leaving. But on the other hand, we know, you know, Samoans are sort of fervent immigrants. There's a strong desire to move. There's massive interest in the New Zealand Samoa quota. That's hugely oversubscribed. So I think once people become aware that right now in Samoa, in Kiribati, you won't be able to apply come June the 3rd, which is when the ballot will open in other countries. Once people become aware of that, I think there will be pressure brought to bear on these governments. And I think eventually they will be they will be given a quota.
When you apply, what will be the critical elements that will come into play?
It's a two-step process. So first of all, you've got to apply for the ballot. And then second, if you're successful on the ballot, then you actually apply for the visa. So it's exactly the same as the New Zealand visa. And the actual ballot application is quite simple. It is online. So you've got to have access to the internet. You've got to pay $25. You've got to be between the age of 18 and 45. But you can also include your partner and dependent in your application. You don't have to be in your country of citizenship. You know, you could be in Australia, for example, but you do have to be born in that Pacific country or have had one of your parents born there. And then I think the biggest challenge for some countries will be that you've got to have a passport even to apply for the ballot. So I know I do a fair bit of work in PNG, and there can be a long delay there in actually getting the passport. A lot of people just don't have a passport, PNG. So definitely I'd advise anyone considering entering the ballots on June the 3rd, but especially those in PNG, to straight away go and apply for a passport.
Can they apply if they haven't got work? Do you have to have work lined up?
You don't need work to apply for the ballot. You've just got to meet those few very minimal criteria. If you're then successful in the ballot, like your name is pulled out of the hat, you then have a period of time where you have to go over the next lot of hurdles. And that includes you've got to do a health check, you've got to have a police check, and then most importantly, you've got to find a job in Australia. You know, once you move to Australia, you don't have to stay in that job, but you've got to actually have a job to go to when you migrate. The Australian government says it will offer a job service to help people find jobs, so I wouldn't be put off by that as a requirement. And I'd also want to clarify that point. It is a requirement that comes as the next step. You don't need a job to enter the ballot.
That's Pacific Waves for today. To listen back, head over to rnzi.com/programs. We're also on Spotify, Apple and iHeartRadio. From myself and the RNZ Pacific team, tō whā soifua.